Chapter 31. Woo, we hardly knew ye, and that's my fault. Hicks had a hard time keeping the carrier centered as he sped through the tunnels. Every time he took a corner, he sideswiped the wall. By the time he got back to ops, he'd have left most of the paint job in the tunnels, like a trail of breadcrumbs. The scrape of metal was a real nerve jangler as well, but it didn't drown out Wu and Garty and all the others in his head. He had to get on top of that, bury it deep, and beat himself up later. Right now he had to concentrate on all the red dots that were pulsing on the grid. What a primitive setup. When he'd said as much, Jackson had responded with a rant about economizing resources and not everything needed life-quality audio-video. He'd almost made a crack about the info dump, then realized it was her way of steadying herself so her head wouldn't explode. Plus, there was one good thing about blinking lights on a black grid. They just went out, sans the gory details you'd never be able to see. Hicks heard less scraping as he whipped the six-wheeler around the next turn. Maybe he was starting to get the hang of this, he thought. Half a second later, he found himself trying to drive through a barrage of brightly colored plastic crates. They rebounded off the Jeep, flew into his face, bounced off his head. The six-wheeler made a valiant effort, but finally stalled out with its nose in the air at a 45-degree angle, trapped in all the happy colors of the circus. Cursing, Hicks grabbed his pulse rifle and climbed out of the Jeep, kicked away a yellow crate nearby, and looked back at the turn. Two large mirrors high on the wall were angled to show people approaching from either direction for any oncoming traffic. But he'd been too preoccupied to see he was about to drive into a secret stash of crates. And what a goddamn enormous stash it was. Crates were stacked floor to ceiling and three deep, taking up almost half the floor space, leaving no room for even the smallest vehicles to pass each other. He was about to try pushing the Jeep free from the crates when he heard a chime and looked up to see a blinking amber light on the ceiling ahead of him. Gotta love those blinking lights, he thought as he ran toward it. Especially when they lead to a freight elevator. The metal jaw-style doors were open as if it had been waiting for him. Don't mind if I do, Hicks said, stepping inside. He yanked the strap dangling from the upper door and the doors came together with a bang, reminding him too much of Jaws. He hit the top button on the control panel. The top level turned out to be the mall. He stepped out of the elevator and found he was close to where he'd come in the first time. It seemed like 100 years since he'd found Tully Charles A. in an ersatz sports bar, getting loaded and trying to decide if a bioweapon was scarier than losing all his shares. Hicks doubted the poor guy had lived long enough to fully regret it. The bar itself was also a casualty. The floor was cratered with ragged holes, with the worst damage in the middle. Hicks decided not to see whether it would hold his weight. Machine fragments were scattered all around, the remains of a heavy loader, Hicks saw, and smiled, grimly. A heavy loader would make a good weapon against an alien. Ripley had used a different model, but Anchor Point didn't have any of those. Probably too expensive. His smile vanished as he spotted several remote controls in the debris. Some were in pieces, some were only cracked, a couple he remembered seeing on Walker's workbench, where they hadn't been crusted with blood. He turned to look at the bar, which, in spite of everything, was still standing. The undamaged pulse rifle sitting on it was the one Rossetti had given Walker back in ops. Over by the pool tables were other, worse things. Chunks of flesh and bone, along with more bloodstains and shreds of the overalls Walker had been wearing. Forgot to warn him not to put his weapon down, Hicks thought, in case he had to use it on himself. They shouldn't have let Walker go off alone in the first place. And then again, it would have been worse if he'd gone bug-fucking ops. A lot worse. Skirting the most damaged part of the floor, he grabbed the pulse rifle off the bar. And as he slung it over his shoulder, he saw the same Haiti versus Brazil playoff game running on the back wall. They probably made the playoffs every year, and always would. This year and next year, and so forth and so on. World without end, amen. He went back out into the mall, which probably hadn't been this quiet since the day before Anchor Point had opened for business. It was strange, but at least he didn't hear any sounds that might have been aliens moving around. Only faint background music and the soft splashing of the artificial waterfall farther up the concourse. This would be humankind's great legacy. Fake waterfalls, reruns of Brazil versus Haiti in the playoffs, and music to shop by. Just ahead of him on the left was a shop with no exterior damage that he could see. The intact front window was startlingly clean with large, old-fashioned gilt letters, Nostalgia, and below it in smaller type, Where the Past is Alive. This week's special had been the early 21st century. Instead of hollow projections, there were three actual mannequins on display. One was posed so it looked fascinated by a small handheld device. Another wore a pair of oversized black goggles and a t-shirt that read, VR plus AR equals you. A mirror ball threw off tiny flashes as it rotated slowly above the third figure, which was decked out in a silvery jacket with a ridiculous amount of shoulder padding, black patent leather trousers, and a shirt proclaiming in glittery silver letters, Disco sucks. The mixed message was amusing, and if Hicks remembered rightly, about 30 years wide of the mark. Still, it must have been nice while it lasted. Inside, the shop had been demolished. Everything, merchandise, display cases, shelves, clothing racks, had been reduced to utter wreckage. Half the lights were either out or flickering on and off, but without a sound. No humming, no buzzing, just flickering. This annoyed Hicks for no reason he could think of, and he went in with the intention of finding the control box and shutting it down. It would be somewhere at the rear of the store. Then he saw them. They were up high on the back wall near the ceiling, two adults and three kids, one of them a toddler, all unconscious in pearlescent black cocoons that left their chests uncovered. Their intact chests. Hicks hoped they really were unconscious as he raised the pulse rifle Walker had never had a chance to use. He took care of them with seven quick bursts and got out of there as fast as he could, flickering lights forgotten. Although he did pause for a brief last look at the front window display, if he hadn't been in the middle of an alien apocalypse, he'd have taken a photo and sent it to Newt. As he moved on, he felt something like a faint trembling deep inside himself. No, he told himself firmly. He couldn't react now. Later, he could lock himself in the John and shudder and shake with LV-426 flashbacks till his bones rattled like maracas. But not now. Abruptly, he caught sight of a transit point sign. The light above the doors blinked yellow, announcing the imminent arrival of a car. Hicks went over and pressed the call button. Seconds later, the doors opened to reveal Spence clutching a commuter strap with both hands, standing in the middle of an abattoir. Every centimeter of the walls, the floor, and the ceiling was painted with blood and things he tried not to look at. As if on cue, one of those things he didn't want to see dropped from the ceiling and landed beside Spence's foot with a terrible wet smack. Spence, Hicks said softly. He reached for her to pull her out of the car. She blinked at him with no sign of recognition and screamed.